everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
I'm Wendy.
Back with you with an all-new episode. But before we get started, I believe Wendy has some updates.
I have two, and they're related to the Corey Edkin case. And thanks to our loyal listener, Dee, for sending them to me. She's also the one who suggested that we cover Corey's case in the first place. Now, if you haven't checked that episode out yet, those three episodes out, or you want to revisit the case, it was a three-part series we posted back in December. Two-year-old Corey Edkin disappeared from his New Columbia, Pennsylvania home in October 1986. Investigators believe Corey may still be alive and left his home with someone he knew. Now, our first update is about Henry Bush. He was an 18-year-old friend of Corey's mother back in 1986, and he was arrested in 2020 for lying about his relationship with her and his activities around the time that Corey disappeared. Now, the update is that Henry ultimately pled no contest to those misdemeanor obstruction charges, and he was sentenced to 1 year of probation in March. So, nothing super new about that other than he got sentenced for those charges, and we don't have more information from that. Meanwhile, Merle Miller, Corey's maternal grandmother, has appealed for a retrial in March. Now, if you listen to the episode, you remember that Merle was accused but acquitted of poisoning her first husband. Then her second husband died in his home on Christmas Day. In 2023, she was sentenced to life in prison for the poisoning death of her third husband, John Nichols. Merle has been convicted on numerous financial crimes throughout her lifetime, and since her murder conviction, suspicion of her role in her grandson Corey's death, disappearance, we don't know that he's dead, but something to do with why he's not around anymore has increased. Now, in her appeal, Merle argues that her conviction was, quote, based on speculation and circumstantial evidence. Merle still contends that she had power of attorney, allowing her to handle John Nichols' finances along with his permission to do so. In her words, it was their money. But if you listen to the episodes, she has a history of fraud, insurance crimes. I don't think it's going to hold weight personally. Now, parts one and two of our three-part series covered Corey's disappearance and Merle's criminal history in depth. There's so much more to this family story in these cases, and they're all interconnected. So with Dee's help, she's keeping us posted on those updates.
We know that there are so many true crime podcasts out there to choose from and only so many hours in the day. And we want to take a moment to say we truly appreciate you choosing to listen to us today. If you want to join the discourse, you can reach out to us on our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or on our social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Criminal Dis Pod or Criminal Discourse Podcast. And one last thing. The views and opinions discussed on Criminal Discourse are just that, our views and opinions, and everyone is presumed innocent until convicted in a court of law.
So where are we headed to this time, Trish?
We are headed to the state of Massachusetts. I think the last time I was there was Helicrafts.
Oh, yes. That was the first Forensic Files episode, correct?
I don't know if that was the first Forensic Files episode. That was the first case in Massachusetts that was a murder conviction without a body.
Oh, I knew it was a major first
one.
She
went through the wood chipper.
Oh, that's right.
So this doesn't involve a wood chipper in this episode. Cara Rentalia was a woman whose life seemed like any other. A devoted wife, a loving mother, and a respected paramedic. But behind closed doors, tensions simmered within her marriage to her wife, Anna Marie Cochran Rentalia. On the evening of March 29th, 2010, police responded to a 911 call from a neighbor of the Rentalias, only to discover Anna Marie's lifeless body at the foot of the basement stairs. The victim of a brutal homicide. A lengthy and convoluted legal saga followed. Despite the lack of physical evidence linking Cara to the crime scene, authorities honed in on her as the prime suspect. As the investigation unfolded, revelations of a troubled marriage plagued by jealousy, possible infidelity, and domestic violence emerged, casting a shadow of suspicion over Cara's every move. Years of legal proceedings, including two highly publicized mistrials, failed to bring about closure in the case. With each passing day, the mystery surrounding Anna Marie's death deepened, leaving a community on edge and a family torn apart by grief and suspicion. Join us as we delve into the case of Cara Rentalia, a story that defies easy answers, a long pursuit of justice, and just how many times it takes to bring about a verdict. It was a little after 7 p.m. on March 29th, 2010, when Roy Dupree answered his door to his frantic neighbor, Cara Rentalia. Cara handed Roy her three-year-old daughter, Brianna, and the family dog, asking him to call 911, telling him that Anna Marie was in the basement. Kara then took back off towards her house. Roy did as asked and called 911, telling the dispatcher that his neighbor had just come over and was pretty distraught. She mentioned the other one being in the basement and didn't say much more before taking off. The dispatcher's reply was, "Oh, maybe a domestic." The call went out to the police and first responders, informing them of a potential domestic situation at the Rentalia residence. 3 minutes later, Granby Police Officer Gary Poehler arrived. Upon entering the house, he could hear yelling coming from the basement. Now, Officer Poehler knew both of the Rentalias as he had worked with them previously, as both were paramedics in the area. Kara was sitting on the concrete basement floor, cradling Anna Marie in her lap, who looked to have been deceased. What was odd about the startling scene was the pinkish-white paint covering the floor, Anna Marie, and Kara. Kara was distraught, hysterically repeating, "She's dead. I can't believe she's dead." Now, Kara was eventually removed from the basement and brought upstairs to the kitchen. Paramedics on the scene, who are again friends of both women, determined that Anna Marie was beyond life-saving measures. Kara told police and first responders that she had just returned home shortly after 7 p.m. after leaving the house around 3 p.m. to run errands with her daughter. When they got home, she heard Brianna say, "Mommy's in the basement." Seeing just Anna Marie's feet, she got scared. She grabbed Brianna and the dog and got them out of the house as quickly as possible. So back in the kitchen, Kara asked if she could wash her hands and change her clothes since she had paint and blood on them. Now, knowing Kara personally, the officer allowed her to do so. Afterwards, the officer did collect her clothing for evidence. Kara continued to tell the officer that she and Anna Marie had been arguing since the previous evening. She stated that, "We should not leave each other mad." She told the officer about her day with a final statement that she understood, quote, "that I'm the number one suspect." So Anna Marie Cochran grew up in a large Irish-Italian family in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield is located in the eastern bank of the Connecticut River and is known as Hoop City, as the game of basketball was invented in 1891 by Canadian James Naismith. Anna Marie is described by those who knew her as boisterous, the life of the party, friendly, kind, charming, compassionate. Her life's motto, live, laugh, and love. She had a passion for helping others, be it two-legged or four-legged. And she was thinking about becoming something in the veterinarian field, but ultimately decided on becoming a paramedic. And it was while working as a paramedic that she met Kara Rentalia, a fellow paramedic in 2002. A year later, in 2003, the state of Massachusetts would issue a landmark ruling legalizing same-sex marriage, the first state to do so. I think eventually in 2015, the United States Supreme Court.
It was a while. I remember the news about individual states until finally it was on a federal level.
Whereas Anna Marie was described as outgoing and extroverted, Kara could be described as the opposite. She was more quiet and reserved, but equally as kind, according to others. She worked hard at her job, and she was good at it. When Anna Marie and Kara met, they hit it off, and the personality opposites fell in love. By 2005, Anna Marie moved into Kara's home in Granby, and by 2007, the couple adopted a six-day-old baby girl, and it was right after this adoption that they got married. This newly formed family had a lot going for them. Anna Marie and Kara had jobs they loved, a baby girl they adored, and a house they could now make a home. But some cracks started to show in what outwardly was a picture of a couple who had it all together. Anna Marie, for all of her positive virtues, and she had them, was an impulsive spender. In a Dateline episode on this case entitled At the Bottom of the Stairs, friends of Anna Marie say things like she liked expensive things, including jewelry and the latest technology gadgets. She was also an amateur photographer, so she had really expensive camera equipment. Anna Marie's impulsivity and generosity to herself and others led to tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt. Financial stress in any relationship can be difficult and lead to arguments, and the Rentalia marriage was no different.
That's a lot of debt, and I guess, too, a lot of things at once, a lot of big things at once, the house, a baby.
Now, the house was Kara's.
Oh, okay.
So she moved into Kara's.
But still moving in together, kind of all at the same time.
And not too long apart.
Yeah.
On September 27, 2008, Anna Maria arrived at the Granby Police Station wanting to file charges of domestic violence against Cara. Anna Maria told the officer on duty that she and her wife had gotten into an argument and Cara had hit her in the head with a spatula. Cara arrived soon after, wanting to tell her side of the story, but instead was arrested and charged with domestic battery. Now, those charges would later be dropped by Anna Maria, and Cara's case never went to trial. 7.5 months later, on May 12, 2009, a 911 call was placed from the Rentalia residence. The dispatcher could hear a woman screaming, "Just leave! Just leave!" before the phone disconnected. Now, when police arrived, both Cara and Anna Maria told the officers, "No, there's no situation." And they said that Brianna must have accidentally dialed the phone and there was no concern. However, that same day, Cara filed for divorce.
And if Brianna is the one, the little girl who called the police, then she might have been scared.
True. Oh. Yes. 2 weeks later, Cara would call 911 telling the dispatcher that she needed help because her wife was threatening to take away her daughter. She kept reiterating that she didn't know what to do and she couldn't get a hold of her lawyer. She went on to tell the dispatcher that, quote, "She is threatening to take everything away from me. My livelihood, my house, my daughter. I feel threatened, but not physically." So that same day, May 26, both Cara and Anna Maria ended up at a local district magistrate's courtroom wanting to take restraining orders out on each other. The judge asked Anna Maria her basis for wanting the restraining order, and Anna Maria told the judge that she had had the sheriff serve Cara divorce papers that day, and she, quote, "went ballistic." She says that she left home with Brianna and returned around 1 p.m. to Cara screaming and yelling, "You're not taking my house. You're not taking Brianna." The judge then turned to Cara, wanting her statement. Cara was emotional and told the judge that she was afraid. "I'm afraid to be in my house because Anne's going to say, because I'm constantly threatened verbally and bodily as far as my personal space all the time. I had to call the police twice and I had to ask what to do about it. And today she's right. I mean, I filed 2 weeks ago and I held it off and then I told," the judge interrupts, asking what was filed 2 weeks ago. Cara said she filed for divorce 2 weeks ago. Cara tells the judge it's a long story, but up until October, it's only been verbal and she's constantly threatens me that she's going to take away my job, my livelihood, my home, my daughter. She's constantly threatening me. She goes on to say, "I want peace in my house. My family lives in Rhode Island and I own my house. I pay the home mortgage myself. I pay all the bills myself. That's why I don't leave. Anne's family lives one town away. I asked if there's any way you could just stay with your family for a little bit, just because, so we don't, there's no volatility in front of Brianna. That's all. I'm just nervous. I don't know what to do." Anna Maria asked the judge if she could speak. She tells the judge that Cara is upset because she wants a divorce. Cara interrupts and says, "No, I filed first, Anne." Anna Maria continues, "I rotate around Cara's schedule. She has a fixed schedule. So when she has to work, I either have to take days off. I'm like the primary caregiver for Brianna. I'm always in the home. I cook, I clean, I do everything for Cara. She made $80,000 last year and I made $20,000 because I'm like a stay-at-home mom with Brianna. Her problem is she doesn't want me to have, I filed for divorce. She's very upset with me." And now at this point, the judge has had about enough.
I bet it's kind of like a tennis match going back and forth.
Yes, going back and forth. And there's one resource in the show notes that you can listen to the audio of this session. That's kind of why I have it in such detail. And he basically tells both of them they can have criminal charges going back and forth between them, but the only one that is going to affect them in the long run is their daughter. He goes on to say, quote, "The two of you can either deal with this as adults and deal with it in probate court as your marriage dissolves, or I'll take, if you want, I'll call DCF right now," DCF being the Department of Children and Families. "But right now, the two of you are going to walk a very fine line. You're either going to exist in that house until you get it straightened out, or you're going to look at criminal charges, one or both of you. And I promise you, if I see that come into this court, I'll be on the phone with DCF so fast, they'll be here before you get out the door."
Oof, he laid it down.
He was not playing with them. So the following month, in June 2009... Anna Maria started a relationship with ex-girlfriend Carla Danielli, a police officer in Springfield, Massachusetts. So Anna Maria and Carla had dated before Anna Maria's relationship with Cara. So by August of 2009, Anna Maria moved out of Cara's house and into an apartment in South Hadley that Carla had helped her move into, and I think helped set her up financially a little bit. She also allowed Anna Marie to use her credit card to help with furnishings and had funded trips for them to go on. One such trip was to Las Vegas, Nevada. In total, over $10,000 in expenses were put on Carla's card. However, by the fall of 2009, Carla would be blindsided by Anna Marie announcing that she was reconciling with Cara, her wife. So this is a very short amount of time and a lot of spending in that short amount of time.
Lot of money, small time. Wow.
So both Cara and Anna Marie agreed to put their differences aside and work on their marriage. Now, I'm not sure if they ended up in counseling or not. There is an episode that covers this case, Tamron Hall's Deadline Crime, and she's interviewing one of Anna Marie's friends, and she makes a mention that they were in counseling. So I'm assuming that hopefully they were in some type of counseling, but I could not verify that anywhere else. So although the couple at this time had a combined total of over $100,000 in debt, so this is both Anna Marie and Cara, they decided to take a trip to Florida, I believe, to visit a family member, and then a Caribbean cruise.
What's a couple thousand more, you know?
And for a short time, it looked like the Rentalias were making it work. Now, that $100,000 in debt, some of it is like their car payments. I think there was some educational expenses. There might have been some of the mortgage on that. But I couldn't get a complete breakdown of how much, whose debt was what. Right. I think the majority, unfortunately, sounds like it was credit card debt. On March 28th, 2010. So this is the day, really the evening before the murder. Anna Marie was working overnight for American Medical Response Emergency Services when she received a text from Cara informing her that her good friend Mike, this is Cara's friend Mike, and I believe a coworker, was stopping by with a six pack of Bud Light for them to split. Now, Anna Marie responded immediately and intensely. So this is the text she sent back to Cara, all caps. "It is becoming very clear how you feel about me. I don't like feeling this way. You are my wife. I hate the relationship we have." Cara's response, also in all caps, "Okay, you are being over the top and crazy for no reason. 3 exclamation points. "It's okay. 1 exclamation point. "He's my friend, period. Not doing anything wrong." Anna Marie's response, quote, "You are rude. I'm going to leave. I don't give a shit. You are rude and disrespectful." So this whole argument is all in caps, back and forth. So as Anna Marie was in this heated exchange with Cara, she was also texting her close male friend and coworker, Mark Olesak, making arrangements for him to visit the house the next day when Cara was out. So according to coworkers of the pair, the two were, quote, very close. And that's all they really would say. They would often exchange texts and phone calls in an overly friendly manner. To Mark's wife, she just knew them to be friends. Perhaps unaware, Mark had obtained a credit card for Anna Marie to use due to her bad credit. Now, this was to help Anna Marie rebuild her credit. Instead, she ran up about $7,000 in credit card debt on it.
Anna Marie, that's not good. That's not good. And then she can't get mad over a coworker coming over for Bud Light. She's using a coworker's credit card. Mm-hmm. This isn't adding up to good things.
No, it's very toxic.
Very, incredibly toxic.
Anna Marie arrived home around 8 a.m. on March 29th. Perhaps the couple could address their argument then, but Cara had been called into work at the Ludlow Fire Department that morning. So I think Anna Marie gets home, Cara's getting ready and she's out the door. And when she arrived at work, she was told that, well, she wasn't really needed. So she turned the car around and went home, arriving around 11 a.m. Now, what happened between the time of Cara's return home and her discovering Anna Marie's body around 7 p.m. that evening would be the focus of the police investigation for the next 18 months. Massachusetts State Trooper Robin Whitney and Jamie Magarin escorted Cara back to the Granby Police Station for further questioning around midnight. Now, 7 minutes into the interview, Lieutenant Whitney asked Cara about the couple's history of domestic violence, and Cara shared that she had been working overtime to make ends meet. She stated that they used to push each other and argue, getting physical back and forth, so she mentioned that to the officer right up front. Cara then said, "I love her. I love her, and I don't want to talk bad about her." But then she would say she felt bullied by Anna Marie. She would describe her as being loud and swearing and belittling her. She also said that Anna Marie could be charming and thoughtful. When asked what she thought happened, Kara said she believed Anne Marie may have fallen down the steps, but also stated that Anne Marie did get into arguments all the time and that she was a thick-headed person who said what she meant and what she felt. Now, while at the station, Kara consented to a search of her person, and the only thing noticeable on Kara was a small mark in the area of her lower neck, upper chest area, and Kara told investigators it had come from a recent consensual encounter with Anne Marie, and there were no other marks or abrasions found on her. So Kara told investigators that Anna Marie had asked her if she could take Brianna out so she could get some sleep, as she was working another overnight shift that evening. Kara said that she left the house with Brianna around 3 p.m. and stopped at several locations, one of them being the Holyoke Mall, where she had gone to the Children's Place and Baby Gap to buy some socks and shirts for Brianna. Next, the pair had pulled into a McDonald's for a bite to eat, but Brianna wanted something different, and remembering she still needed to get some things for Brianna's lunch the next day, they went to the Stop and Shop grocery store. So after purchasing a few items there, they traveled to a Burger King to purchase some mac and cheese, that's what Brianna had wanted, and afterwards the pair had headed home. Kara admitted that she had texted Anna Marie and left several voicemails for her when she didn't get a response while she was out. And investigators found that odd, as the whole purpose of Kara and Brianna leaving the house was for Anna Marie to get some rest. So Kara was released after questioning. The police wanted to interview Kara again in the immediate future, but would be unable to due to her retaining David Hose, an attorney who advised against it. Kara Rentalia would never talk to the police again. Now, during the following 18 months, authorities would investigate Kara's version of events and confirm details of her afternoon travels. So 4 days after Anna Marie's death, Northwestern District Attorney Elizabeth Scheibel announced that Anna Marie had died by strangulation. Anna Marie had 23 distinct bruises all over her body, all considered recent and fresh. She also had multiple blunt force injuries to her head that may have been caused by a fall down the stairs onto the concrete basement floor. Now, when the first two officers and paramedics arrived in the basement around 7:15 p.m., they noted that the paint looked very wet and shiny. One paramedic noted that the paint looked fresh, with no film having set on top of it. Anna Marie had been lying in what looked like a large pool of pink, wet paint. Anna Marie's body was also telling, as she was noted to be very cold to the touch and her body extremely stiff. When paramedics went to move her body, she moved as one solid piece. That means that rigor mortis had already set in. Now, rigor mortis is the chemical reaction that will cause fibers in the muscles to become locked, occurring a few hours after death. The night of Anna Marie's murder, extensive photographs were taken of the scene, and these photographs were taken around 9:18 p.m. The basement, including Anna Marie, had been covered in Glidden Easy Track ceiling paint, and this paint, when initially poured, has a pinkish tint, but will dry to a white color within an hour. Investigators also took photos of the back door that had semicircular marks on the door frame. The authorities determined that due to no corresponding marks on the door itself, no damage done to the lock, the door had been opened when those marks had been made. Now, what wasn't done at the scene were any measurements of the pools of paint, such as the depth or thickness of the paint. Also, Anna Marie never had her core body temperature taken. According to the medical examiner, she had died 6 to 8 hours, perhaps 12, before first responders arrived, putting her time of death between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Yeah, there's a wide swath there. So as Kara had told police in her kitchen, she realized she was the prime suspect, and she was right. However, there were two other individuals that the police had to look at, Anna Marie's ex-girlfriend, Kara Danielli, and her close male friend and co-worker, Mark Olesak. Now, when police questioned Mark, he admitted that Anna Marie and him were extremely close and often flirted with one another, but said their relationship was purely platonic. Mark and Anna Marie had met on the job in early 2000s and immediately hit it off. And initially, when asked where he was the day of her murder, Mark had told the police he had gone to a physical therapy appointment and then had gone home for the rest of the day. Now, authorities, through their investigation, would talk to Mark again once it was determined he hadn't told them the truth. When they talked to Mark again, he said he had forgotten all about the other places he had gone that day after his physical therapy, including furniture shopping, a Walmart, and a Weiss grocery store. Mark also told police that the text messages he had with Anna Marie the day of her murder was more tongue-in-cheeky about him coming over when Kara was out, since that had been what the couple had been arguing about the day before. Like, it wasn't really serious for him to do that. He also told police that he had given Anna Marie $350 4 days before her murder. She said she wanted to purchase a puppy with it. Police would come back again to question Mark about a text message that he had deleted off of his phone. This text message was sent at 1:39 p.m. Mark had texted Anna Marie that he had just found out his sister had been diagnosed with cancer, and he never received a reply, which was out of character for Anna Marie. She was a prolific texter, caller, using her phone all the time. So besides Mark Olesak, there was Anna Marie's ex-girlfriend, Springfield Police Officer Carla Danielli. Danielli told police that she had been at a gym in Longmeadow in the early afternoon and then had gone out for a run afterwards. And investigators were able to obtain video evidence of Danielli's vehicle pulling into the gym parking lot on the day of the murder. So she was also ruled out as a suspect. So after 18 months of investigation, a grand jury was presented evidence along with the state's theory that Cara and Anna Marie had a, quote, acrimonious, at times violent marriage that culminated with Cara strangling Anna Marie on March 29th. Cara then tried to cover up her involvement by driving around all afternoon, disposing of evidence, and attempting to communicate with Anna Marie to demonstrate that she believed her to be alive. Cara intentionally poured paint on Anna Marie and lifted her body onto herself before police arrived to make it more difficult to investigate. The grand jury found that there was enough evidence and handed down a bill of indictment. And in October 2011, Cara, who by then had sold her home in Granby and moved in with her parents in Rhode Island, was arrested and charged with the first-degree murder of her wife, Anna Marie Cochran Rentalia. Cara would be the first woman in Massachusetts history to be charged with murder of a legally wedded spouse. She was held without bail, and it would be another 18 months where pretrial motions would take place until Cara's trial. But on February 20th, 2013, Cara's first trial took place. Dr. Joanne Richman, a medical examiner, testified as to the time of death. And in Dr. Richman's opinion, Anna Marie's time of death was, again, 6 to 8 to 12 hours before first responders arrived at the Rentalia home. So anywhere really between 9:13 a.m. and 1:13 p.m.
But even with that wide window of time, this only puts suspicion really on Cara, because it would either have to be before Cara got home or in that window of time when she was talking to her to take their daughter out. Either way.
Yes. So the prosecution provided evidence that Anna Marie, again, was an avid cell phone user, often texting it or emailing others. And her last outgoing phone call was to her aunt at 12:21 p.m. Now, based on cell phone data, prosecutors theorized that she was murdered after 12:21 p.m. up to 2 p.m., which would still put Cara in the residence by her own account. The prosecution also laid out for the jury what was found when police verified Cara's timeline on the day of the murder. Based upon Cara's interview with authorities, she said that she left the residence with her daughter around 3 p.m. This was at Anna Marie's request so that she could get some rest for her shift that night. Authorities were unable to verify where Cara went until she showed up on video at 5 p.m. at the Holyoke Mall. Now, according to Google MapQuest, the time between Granby and the Holyoke Mall is approximately 20 to 25 minutes. Now, in the back of Cara's pickup truck that could be seen on video from the mall, you can see a laundry basket and a red bag. Keep that in mind. Next, Cara's truck is caught on surveillance at the McDonald's restaurant at 5:47 p.m. However, she does not go in or pull into the drive-thru, instead driving around to the back of the parking lot and stopping briefly to get out and throw away some trash in the bin. Authorities did collect that trash and found three rags. One of them looked to have faint blood stains on them. Now, when tested, lab technicians testified the DNA that was found on one of the rags could have perhaps belonged to Anna Marie, but the sample was inconclusive. So after McDonald's, Cara then drove to the Stop and Shop grocery store, arriving around 6 p.m. She and Brianna go inside. They purchase some items, leaving around 6:19. Then the pair drive to the Burger King to purchase some mac and cheese that Brianna had been requesting. And surveillance video from the Burger King still shows the laundry basket and the red bag in the back of Cara's truck. Now, after their final stop, the pair head the 5.5 miles home. What wasn't found in the back of Cara's truck when she returned home was the basket and bag. And to this day, it has never been found. And I couldn't find anything discussing what happened to it. What was also presented to the jury were the various text messages and phone calls left on Anna Marie's cell phone. Cara left three voicemails that were played for the jury. The first one at 5:52 p.m. And this is the call. Hey, it's me. I mean, I know you're mad, and like, Mike is, you know, I work with him, honey. He's one of my closest friends, but there's no reason to still be mad. I mean, my gosh, seems like we were getting along fine earlier. You know, partly, so we're going to go pick up some bread. We changed our minds and went around the Rotary. It's like Big Ben. Anyways, Brianna says hi, she loves you, and I love you, and we're still driving. Love you, bye. 3 minutes later, a second voicemail is left, and you can hear Brianna say, quote, turn around. Kara responds, I know that I have to turn around. And, hey, listen, it's me again. Come on, you're starting to make us worried. Like, what's up? You're normally fine. You get mad, but then, you know, you at least text back or call. Either way, Brianna breaks in. Where are you going? Kara, well, remember we forgot to get stuff for your lunch tomorrow in school. Brianna, school? Kara, yeah. Brianna, can I go back? Kara, yes, we're going to go home. But Brianna then says something inaudible. Kara's reply is, no, it's not the wrong way. We're going the right. I missed the Stop and Shop, honey. I can't send crackers and cheese and crackers. You know, the chewy N-E-M-O-S. So anyways, maybe got to pick up some other fruit like bananas or something. Anyways, love you. Bye. Call us, okay? Bye. The final voicemail is made at 6:42 p.m., 47 minutes later. Hey, Anne, I'm starting to really freaking worry. I'm more worried, but actually part of me is just irritated. It's like I know you don't call when you get upset, you know, and I told you, it's only Mike. It's my buddy. Mike's okay. Anyways, we're going to Burger King. Thought we would come out of the mall, and of course she's hungry, and I didn't hear from you, so I thought we'd hit the McDonald's. She didn't want McDonald's. No, she wants mac and cheese. The only thing that has mac and cheese is Burger King. Oh, good job, honey. On our way to Burger King. Please call. Please, please, bye. So defense attorney Ho's focus was to show the jury that the police failed to consider other suspects, namely Olesak and Daniele, because they had a preconceived notion that this was a domestic violence situation. The defense, either on direct or cross, let the jury know that Olesak had not been forthcoming in his first two interviews with police as to his whereabouts the day of the murder. The importance of buying the kitty litter was significant. That's what he purchased at the Weiss Market, because small traces of cat hairs were found on Anna Marie's body despite not owning a cat for over 9 months. He had also admitted to deleting a text that he had sent to Anna Marie around 1:39. So once the jury deliberation started, the prosecution was hopeful for a quick resolution. But by the fourth day of deliberations, the jury reported they were hung. Six of the jurors did not believe that the prosecution had proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt for the only charge they could deliberate on, murder in the first degree. There were no other charges. Kara was denied bail after the mistrial was called, as the prosecution, with Anna Marie's family support, decided they would try her for a second time. And that second trial began in January 2014 and was a replica of the first trial, but with a different jury. The prosecutor hoped for a better outcome, but would once again be disappointed. The jury, in an 8-4 deadlock, could not come to a unanimous verdict. Once again, a mistrial was called. Kara's defense moved to have her indictment dismissed, which was denied, but she was allowed out on $100,000 bail with GPS monitoring. So if at first you don't succeed, try again. And that's just what the prosecutor's office decided to do. On October 7, 2016, Kara Rentalia stood trial for the third time. The prosecutors did make some changes to their strategy, though. They added a second medical examiner's opinion as to time of death. Another new addition was the testimony of a paint expert who testified as to when the paint that was covering Anna Marie and the floor was poor. The defense protested the omission of this testimony from David Giulinelli, a quality engineer from Glidden Paint. They did not feel he met the standard as an expert witness. That was the defense's motion. But Judge Rapp disagreed and allowed the testimony in. The other new addition was allowing the jury to consider a lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter. So Giulinelli testified that based upon his experiments, the paint was poured from the container and not spilled, so she didn't fall down the steps, hit the container, and then the paint spilled. He felt that this pouring of paint occurred within a half hour of the first responders arriving on scene. So this new testimony seemed to have swayed the jury in reaching a unanimous verdict, which they reached after 4 days of deliberation. As the verdict was read, Kara Rentalia was found guilty of first-degree murder. Kara could be heard repeating, you're wrong. You're wrong. A first-degree murder conviction carries an automatic life sentence without the possibility of parole in Massachusetts. Kara was removed from the courtroom in handcuffs and sentenced 2 weeks later, and her defense started their appeal. Now, appeals take time, and again, this one was no different. Kara's defense appeal was based upon the fact that the judge had erred in allowing Giulianelli's testimony as he did not meet the standards as an expert witness. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court agreed and overturned Kara's conviction on September 27th, 2021. And in November 2021, Kara was released on $50,000 bail and once again returned to her parents' home in Rhode Island with GPS monitoring. So I do have that appeal in the show notes. It is an interesting read. When you appeal, you can actually add testimony that wasn't given to the judge to make a decision on terms of who's an expert witness. There are standards, scientific methods that have to be reached. And what the court found was that this guy just did his own experiments, that there was no scientific method followed. So that's why he shouldn't have been deemed an expert witness. So almost 2 years later, the Northwestern District Attorney's Office decided that they would try Kara for an exceedingly rare fourth time. Kara's trial started on September 13th, 2023. 13 years after Anna Marie's death. This time, the prosecutors decided to focus on the crime scene and Kara's timeline. They pared down their witness list and did not put on the pain expert on the stand. They focused on the condition of Anna Marie's body when first responders arrived, stiff and cold with well-developed rigor mortis. Kara's new defense attorney from Boston, Rose Marie Scapiccio, who held to the same playbook of pointing out that from the beginning, starting with the 911 call where Anna Marie's murder was labeled a domestic violence incident, Kara became the primary focus. To prove this point, Scapiccio also pointed out 7 minutes into Kara's interview at the station, the investigator asking about their domestic violence history. She also told the jury that the prosecutor wants you to focus just on Kara and not a word about Mark Olesak, who was in love with Anna Marie. When they got around to interview him 2 days later, he gives them an alibi, only to find out almost a year later that Mark is still sleeping in Anna Marie's sleeping bag that they used at work. Their exchange of I love you text and the deleted text and the $7,000 of debt. Scapiccio also provides a bank statement for Carla Danielli that showed she had used an ATM in the opposite direction she told the police she had run that afternoon of the murder, which was closer to Anna Marie's house. So this defense attorney was going all out to show that there were other viable suspects that the police did not focus on because they were tunnel visioned on Kara. This trial lasted 10 days with 20 witnesses for the prosecution and 2 for the defense. This trial would have a short jury deliberation of just 2 days and 16 hours when they came back with a verdict of guilty for voluntary manslaughter. That was also included in this trial as an option for the jury. In Massachusetts, a voluntary manslaughter conviction carries a maximum sentence of 20 years. Now, at Kara's sentencing, the judge read 40 letters of support for Kara, along with a verbal statement that her daughter Brianna made, begging the judge to send her mother home, the only mother she knew, saying that she needed her. The judge sentenced Kara to 12 to 14 years behind bars with time served. At this time, Kara Rentalia has served 8 years and could be released in 4 to 6 more years.
How do you feel? Do you think she'll get released?
I mean, at most, she has 6 years. And yes, she'll get released.
Yeah.
Because that's what the judge sentenced her to. She could possibly be released in 4. I think the fourth jury got it right. I don't think this was a premeditated murder. I think this was a volatile relationship between two people that when they separated and had filed for divorce, they should have remained separated.
Yeah.
You know, and just work through the custody issues with Brianna. But I think there's a lot of feelings there. There was a lot of anger there, a lot of jealousy, mistrust on both sides. And I think just from how the prosecution laid it out, I think when Kara got home from work, when she wasn't needed and returned home, their argument ensued again. I think perhaps one of them, don't know, this is total speculation, that someone opened that basement door, because normally that probably would have been closed because you have a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. You're not leaving a basement door open. So maybe open the door to go downstairs to put laundry in or get away, and arguing either tripped or fell, but was seriously injured. We know she was seriously injured. And if she was still alive, maybe she said, that's it, you're going to jail, threatened Kara. Kara, knowing what the judge had said about Brianna being taken away and her losing her livelihood, her freedom, her home, strangled her.
Yeah.
And then tried to cover it up.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me. The coworker, the police officer girlfriend, I mean, they kind of had motives. That's a really suspicious situation.
It worked for the first two juries. They did not feel that the prosecution had, beyond a reasonable doubt, proven that Kara was responsible.
Right. And that makes me really surprised that they went with the first degree murder charges only those first two trials, because it doesn't seem like they had a lot of physical evidence connecting Kara to the crime scene.
They didn't. But they based it on the fact, I think, because she had not just the act of self-strangling her, but then tried to make it look like a potential break-in and then covering the body with pain and then trying to set up this alibi, like almost premeditated after the fact, you know, trying to cover it up. That's why they went for that first degree murder conviction. They felt strongly on it. I think perhaps had they offered voluntary manslaughter as an option, she probably would have been convicted of that earlier. And had they, she'd probably almost be done with her time.
Yeah. But she still contends 100%
that she is innocent. Yes, that she did not do this. She would not do this.
All the suspicious things in her timeline have reasonable explanations, according to her. Wow. I guess the other thing, too, that I was thinking of is listener tip. Do not get involved with people who are already in relationships, no matter how tempting it is, because that seems to be a...
That's messy. That was,
it got a little messy.
It's messy.
It could potentially put you as a suspect in a murder investigation.
The one thing that also came out through this research, and I couldn't pinpoint a timeline when this happened, but Kara did discover that Anna Marie had opened a credit card in her name and charged $25,000. And I think it might have been around the time of that 911 call that they blamed on Brianna, where someone was screaming, just leave, just leave. But she had found out that again, this debt, I mean, financial stress alone, $100,000, no joke. But she's running up credit cards. I mean, $25,000 in, you know, Kara's name. That's fraud. There's the $10,000 with Carla, but nothing I read said that Carla wanted the money back, that she freely spent this money. And then the $7,000 with Mark Olesak in a very short period of time.
And that's not just platonic, no matter what he says. He was expecting more from that, I think.
I don't know if he was expecting more or not, maybe hoping for more. But as far as I could tell, everyone said that this was just, I mean, very close relationship, but a platonic relationship. And the sleeping bag, the prosecutor in an interview, I think it was the Dateline one, might have been the Cameron Hall one, says that this was the sleeping bag they bought together to use when they had overnight shifts. If you didn't have to work, you could get some rest if you weren't on call, and that they shared it together at the station. However, there are other things I read said it was a pink sleeping bag. So I'm not sure. I'm like, okay, I'm not really sure where this is. A lot of the information kind of wasn't clear. It was coming from one side or the other, but it is a sad case. Yeah, there was domestic violence in this situation. These were two women that were very volatile together and very toxic. And when they separated, they should have stayed separated, but they didn't.
And that child went through a lot, yes, too. And now doesn't have any parent at home.
Has her grandparents. That's it. Yeah. And I think now Brianna, at least at her mom's trial, was 16 at this time. 16 years old.
Pretty much all of her childhood was taken up by the ups and downs of this relationship.
And she said in court, you know, that Kara is the only mother she knew. And to Anna Marie's family, they blame that fact on Kara not letting her know her other mother.
Oh. So still
lots
tension.
Of feelings, still tension. But if you are ever in a relationship that is toxic, is volatile, is abusive, please get help. Please get out.
Yeah, this is safely. The worst.
Yeah, this is the worst case scenario. There are local state organizations that can help you. There are national organizations that can help you. Don't stay in a situation because you think it'll get better.
You don't want a judge sorting it out this way. Mm-hmm. If you want to learn more about today's case, you can head on over to our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com. There you'll find detailed show notes and all the resources that Trish used to put this episode together. And we invite you to join the discourse and let us know your thoughts on today's or any other case through our website contact page or by messaging us on social media. You can reach out anytime to tell us more about yourself or suggest a new case for us to cover. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Leave us a 5-star review and tell a friend so they can join the discourse too.
So as always, if you see something, know something, say something, you might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve this crime. I think in this case, it was really just the prosecutors and the police honing down on Kara's initial statements.
Yeah, and to the, what was it, Carla and Mark, who were other people associated with Anne-Marie, don't lie to the police, don't delete your text messages. Whether maybe Mark is trying to, in my mind, this is me speculating, he's trying to downplay the relationship with his wife. Just deal with that and not lie to the police, because you don't want the worst thing to be you're going to prison for a crime you don't commit.
Mm-hmm. And before we go, remember to stay safe out there, be kind to one another, and let's watch out for one another. Until next time, guys. Bye.